ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The ABC will have me on because they know the listeners won't necessarily be put off by my, you know, pseudo-nuanced rambling.
We'll be the judge of that.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see.
Hello, I'm Virginia Trioli, and welcome to You Don't Know Me, the podcast in which I ask some of Australia's biggest names seven big questions. My guilty pleasure is...
I love cutting down trees with my chainsaw.
This episode, I'm cutting through the many layers of music man Tim Minchin. We'll get to the chainsaws in just a minute. A household name at home, but known all around the world for bringing Matilda to the stage, as well as the timeless classic Groundhog Day. Tim Minchin, you're here to relive it all.
Hi, how are you?
And we had to figure out the trademark look here, didn't we?
Well, there was talk of beanie on, beanie off, hair in, hair out. These are the burdens of my life. These are the difficult decisions.
They are difficult, but I'm going to start off with a hair question.
Oh, yeah.
So for how long has the hair been this long? And when did you decide that, hey, this is a thing, it's a trademark thing, I'm keeping it?
Well, I had long hair sort of straight after school. When you go to an all-boys private school, the first thing you want to do is grow the hair over the collar, you know, as an act of outrageous rebellion. And then somewhere in the 90s, late 90s, it became very trendy in Perth to sort of wear op shop tracksuits and shave your head in a kind of post-train spotting kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
I don't know,
ooh.
Really weird.
That's a harsh look.
Yeah, so I shaved my head and my wedding photos are all number one.
okay.
And then I slowly grew it back. And in late 2004, it was like my hair's really curly and it was this sort of buffy buff. And I straightened it and went, oh, it's quite long actually now that it's straight. And very soon after that, I sort of started performing with a bit more eyeliner on. And very soon after that, things started going very well for me. And I thought, well, it seems to correlate with long straight hair, I better not change that or I might revert to my pre-success state.
So you're superstitious then?
I don't suppose I'm superstitious. I'm sure I'll cut it off. A role will come along that requires me to cut it off. I don't want to be playing rock stars and hippies for the rest of my life. But my fans, when I've posted photos of me wigged up for a role or, you know, they are not happy. I mean, they basically say, dude, you're ugly with short hair. Don't do it.
So nice, so nice. You had your hair flowing and out for Judas, didn't you?
Oh, no, it's been 18 years since I had short hair, yeah.
There are so many projects and wonderful musicals and successes and moments in your life to talk about, so we're going to have to cram it all in. Our first question is always, you'd never know it, but
I think maybe they would know it, but I'm terrible at anecdotes or like telling jokes. I'm not an anecdotalist. People always expect people like me to be, like if I go on Conan or Corden or any of these American chat
shows.
You'll
have all the stories.
They're like, so what, tell us something funny that happened on the set of, or tell us a funny thing that happened in the traffic on the way to. And I'm just like, oh, my brain doesn't work like that.
Okay, so this is interesting because I know a few people like you. So do you think your brain just clears stuff out at a certain point? Like there's a dump. The computer just dumps it all to make room for the next and you don't remember the stories?
I think I'm not great at remembering. I don't have a great memory. I think anecdotalists, their brain is doing it all the time. They're telling the story of events in their heads. And that's the way they unpack life is
to
go.
They're refining it as
they go.
They're
refining a story. And they might not be doing it for the purpose of entertainment, but when they're chatting, the stories they'll tend to tell. Oh, my God, did you go to that? Well, I went to that. And oh, that was the night when I met my friend. And oh, my God, so funny. And on and on.
If I ask you to tell me a joke, have you got a joke?
I only store the most offensive jokes I've ever heard. Only because they're like, you're like, oh, that's terrible.
Well, they're memorable.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I remember my favourite joke at the moment, probably really ever, is one my daughter told me is, why do you... Well, see, I don't remember it. Why do you never see elephants hiding in trees?
I don't know. Why do you never see them?
Because they're good at it.
Okay.
You know, so that's the level of joke I remember.
What about the fork in the road? The question is, the fork in the road I almost took was?
Well, I'm terrible at these questions as well, but when I first moved to Melbourne in 2002, just after Sarah and I got married, I didn't have much hope for myself. You know, I was trying to shop this album I'd made in my house around, just, you know, wanting to get a record deal, I suppose. And I was trying to get an agent, and I couldn't get an agent. But I did do an open audition for The Lion King when it was first coming to Australia, and the callbacks were held at the Malt House, and I think I had to send in a tape or something. But I got a call back for Pumbaa.
Oh, wow.
And I did quite well. And
the hair would have helped.
Yeah, that's right. And Pumbaa, for those who forget, is the sort of, you know, the kind of Faustian warthog who's yes. all like, you know.
Did you do it with an accent?
Yeah, I had to do this song. And it's just emulating the movie. But I didn't choose that fork, but it was, I think about, I know the guy who eventually got that role, and he's amazingly talented and has gone on to do great stuff. But speaking of rejection and importance of that stuff, if I had got that role, I would have done 2 years or something of the same show, 8 shows a week, and the paycheck would have gone up and up, and I would have been in that world, and I would never have done what I did, which is to create this cabaret show, which was just a reaction to my frustration that no one was noticing that I was okay at some stuff, you know, because I didn't fit into the mold for actors and I didn't fit into the mold for rock stars.
You would have just kept in that comfortable life of getting the next job and getting the next job and being second. Who knows?
But yes, that feels right back then, 20 years ago when I almost was Pumbaa, that feels like an important imposed fork.
What was that affirmation like? Because that live show, the songs that came from that and the songs that you subsequently wrote and just how cherished they have become in terms of satire and comedy, but also very emotional songs and how they feel embedded in our minds. How did that feel? How did you experience that?
I think I haven't very well. I think it's something I'd really like to work on so that I don't miss my whole life thinking about the next thing. But I think it's connected to the non-anecdotalist part of my brain. I have struggled to see the moments as they occur.
So you find it hard to be present?
I find it hard to be present, I think, and I know there are solutions to that, and I don't do it.
What are the solutions?
Well, meditation and mindfulness exercises and stuff, and I don't pursue them. I love running and I love playing the piano, and they are meditations to me, but I'm not sure they help with this problem. So it's an interesting thing. I think I would like to chat about that on some other interview about mindfulness, but I do think I think it comes from years of not, you know, that 10 years where I didn't get far. I got a bit sort of chippy, a bit like, well, the doors are always closed. And when people started opening doors, I was very skeptical of them. When I went to Edinburgh in 2005, you know, some guy was like, we're going to make you a star. And someone's like, you're going to be huge. And I was like, they tended to be Americans who use that language.
Clearly.
But I was incredible. I was like, no, you're not. That's absolute nonsense. I don't trust a word you're saying. And I've always been a bit, so when success comes, I'm not a punch the air guy. I'm not a like stand up at the podium when I win an award and go, you know, I'd like to thank God and my mum, and I always knew I was going to have my name in lights and I've done it. Yay me. I just don't have any of that in me. I feel
you're waiting for the fuse to blow.
I'm waiting
for
the fuse to blow and the lights to go out, or I'm going, what an absolute bundle of luck it was that got me here. How do I make sure I don't blow it and let myself and everyone down? Like, that's a bit more defensive, but somewhere around that realm.
The fences are making sense defense.
Yeah.
What about I always?
I was going to say I always try to give, this sounds self-aggrandizing, but I'm not sure it is. I always try to give an honest account of myself. And I say that because it's sort of the defining thing about who I am in the public sphere, is I have decided I'm not going to stop trying to give an honest account of myself, even though it would serve me better to just shut the hell up and give short answers about the product I'm trying to flog.
Are you good at apologizing?
I think I am good at apologizing, but I think there's a very limited space in which it's useful, and the notion of apology has been subsumed by an absolute nonsense version of it, which is people gathering people to put pressure on someone to performatively apologize for something that they don't feel guilty about. And it's useless. It doesn't help the perpetrator. It doesn't help the victim. It doesn't help anyone. And it's not taken as sincere because it wasn't formed out of sincerity.
There's a lot of that going around. But in giving an honest account of yourself, and as you say, just get out there and push the product, move the units for goodness sake. Have you had people in your lives from time to time saying, Tim, you're making it a bit harder than you need to by doing this
stuff?
Yeah,
I think so. And also there's important cultural movement to take into account if you're what I have turned out to my absolute surprise to be a powerful, you know, wealthy white guy with a huge platform. And I'm hyper aware of what that means in 2022. So it's not always appropriate for me to unpack everything I think, because who the hell cares what I think?
Sometimes it's just about shutting up.
It's about shutting up. And I think I've done a bit of that. Sometimes it's really important to use your platform and not shut up. But I actually, what I want to do is be honest, and to the extent that it's useful to anyone, to model honest unpacking of ideas from the only perspective I have, which is my own, tempered by everything I consume and read and listen to. I can't not tell you what I actually think. It's not in my makeup, which is why my answers are always very long.
Happy with that. What about I never
give short answers in interviews?
Yeah, I got that one.
Ever. I can't do it.
Do you see the look come over the eyes of the Conans and the whatever going, oh, my God, we've got to get to the ad break here.
Oh, my God. No,
please bring this story to a point.
Totally. But it's also a self-selecting tendency. So you know, the ABC will have me on because they know the listeners won't necessarily be put off by my, you know, pseudo-nuanced rambling.
We'll be the judge of that.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see.
We talked about your early life in music, and of course it's continued solidly through. Were you a Broadway baby? I mean, because you've ended up just being a Broadway god or a contemporary one. But was that in your veins and in your interest early on?
I think so. I'm
what do you
not,
remember as a child back then in hearing of Broadway?
Early memories are going to the Gilbert and Sullivan Society in Perth with my gran and seeing HMS Pinafore and the Gondoliers. And there was a very active GNS society, which there were for years all around the colonies. You
and
know.
Did you love it?
Oh, I think so. I think I was completely blown away. I think I saw John English do Pirate, but that was a bit later, the Pirate King in Pirates of Penzance. And we had a pianola, pedal piano.
Oh, yeah.
That was a huge part of our lives. And not just, a lot of people have pedal pianos and a few rolls, but my great-grandma had 200 piano rolls. I don't know if people know what I'm talking about, but
yes,
a lot of
do.
Those old show tunes were on our pianola as well. And then when my parents took me to the UK, all four of us to the UK for a holiday in 1985, we saw a couple of Lloyd Webbers. We saw Starlight Express and Cats. And Starlight Express, I was like, and then in my teens, again, it's all Lloyd Webber, it's Superstar. I became very, very into Jesus Christ Superstar, just listening to the record and singing it through.
That's it. If you of our vintage, and I think we're similar, I think I'm a bit older than you, but Jesus Christ Superstar, that was just a turning point, wasn't it? There'd been nothing like that before.
I'm not sure there's been anything like it since. I
mean,
Hamilton is the closest of capturing, but Hamilton's captured a pop. It's pop hip hop. It's beautifully written, but the style of music is quite pop.
But in the same way as a Superstar was rock.
Well, it was, but rock was not that Deep Purple style rock that he was emulating. It wasn't on the mainstream. It was more counterculture than Hamilton is. Hamilton is, Lin-Manuel's incredible. But there was something about Jesus Christ Superstar. There was the Tommy musical, and they were written by The Who, and there was Godspell, another religious thing.
Which followed.
Yeah, that's right. It just seems to me like it sits in a very strange place in culture, and I'm still very fond of it. I loved musicals, but I'm not a fan of musicals. I didn't go and look through the entire, I haven't seen most of them, you know.
But you've written award-winning musicals, and they've been celebrated on Broadway and elsewhere, Matilda and Groundhog Day, which just must feel spectacular. Is it fun? Is it really like the merry band of Broadway workers that it seems from this distance?
Oh, no, Broadway is horrible. I mean, Broadway, so people call these Broadway, my musicals are West End musicals, darling. I mean, my musicals
Pardon.
Won, my musicals won Olivier Awards, not Tony's.
And, excuse me.
And quite famously didn't win Tony's.
Like, no, nominated for 7, I think, at the
well,
Groundhog Day.
Well, yeah.
I mean, we're not counting.
No, that's right. But Matilda lost the Best Musical Tony to Kinky Boots on Broadway. And I don't think I need to finish that sentence. I mean, no, Broadway, that you're right, the merry band is true. I'm being very mean. The actors are amazing, and the work ethic and those theatres and the, you know, all those unionised workers who have been doing it for years, mm-hmm. and the protection and the fans and the fact that you're near Times Square, and it's all sort of lovely, but behind this is this layer of ruthless business. Broadway's like, oh yeah, man, it's like might as well be Randwick in terms of the kind of sort of backroom deals and dodginess. Broadway and I have some healing to do. But I do love making theatre. My God, the before it's all about ticket sales and awards, before it's even opening night, that just relentless pursuit of making something very detailed better with fellow artists, with performers and musicians and technicians and designers, nothing is better.
Tell us about a time, or you answer the question, the time I got it terribly wrong was... And I'm going to need short answers here.
Yeah, I don't like relitigating things. But I think on a broader sense, where I got it wrong was I was part, like many of us were, of when Twitter and social media came along, we realised it was a sort of tool for polemic, for kind of gathering a horde and having an opinion about someone. And I very quickly realised that that was very, very wrong. So the couple of times, like, I retweeted someone's opinion who was cruel to me or said something I disagreed with, and I retweeted it. A lot of your listeners know what I'm talking about. And then suddenly there'd be 100 of my followers joining me at piling onto that person.
Yeah.
And I hate that, and I'm shocked every day that people still do it, that people seem happy to initiate pylons because they think the righteousness of their moral stand is so pure.
That's a really great answer. That is really good. It's a small thing, but I'm still so proud that I...
learned piano, actually. I mean, I don't know if that's small or not, but I can't believe I got... I mean, I'm not a very good pianist, but I got... For someone who didn't really have much guidance, I got pretty good. And I can't quite believe it.
And you got a career. You got a career out of that early decision to keep doing the scales.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, didn't even do the scales. I just sort of noodled around.
Don't say that. There are kids listening. They need to hear that you did the scales.
I'm already on the record of like, you don't have to practice. You just have to play. You just have to play. Just play.
Why did I let him near a microphone? My secret pleasure or my guilty pleasure is?
My guilty pleasure is probably cutting down trees and burning them.
You like an open fire.
I love an open fire, and I love my chainsaw.
Okay, so you can pile on to Tim Minchin here.
But I need to mitigate.
His CO2 emissions are out of control.
It is terrible. I have a block, and there's a lot of non-native species. I'm on the upside. I'm trying to
I don't defend yourself.
I'm trying to re-nativize this block, but it does involve cutting down some native trees, actually small native trees, to create space for other species. But I've love it. I love cutting down trees with my chainsaw and then cutting them up and then waiting for them to dry and then lighting them. And I don't do it very often because it's very, very bad.
Do we mitigate our emissions here?
Yeah, I try, but I'm not going to try and greenwash myself.
You Don't Know Me is presented by me, Virginia Trioli. It's produced by Kelsey Rotino and Jules Hay, with audio production by Michael Black. Coming up next time, someone who's also sung in Jesus Christ Superstar, but you know her for so much more.
I actually never planned to be a singer. I wanted to be a dancer. I know that sounds bizarre. I know.
Kate Ciberano is my guest for You Don't Know Me. Follow us now on the ABC Listen app so you don't miss a thing. And thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.